Hi, everybody. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Indirect Democracy. Welcome to podcast number 4, Indirect Democracy. This week on Indirect Democracy, we'll be looking at the price of gasoline in the upcoming elections, the path to 9/11 as it relates to Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. I'll also have the presidential horoscope, news updates, a global warming story. We have a new sponsor and the What a Weenie Award. Whew. Oh my God. How am I going to do that all in 30 minutes? Well, as I said, welcome. This is podcast number 4 of Indirect Democracy, found at www.indirectdemocracy.com. I am your host, David, and what a week it was. Presidential speeches, missing babies, Anna Nicole's kid, death threats at college football games, and, you know, to be honest with you, I don't plan on talking about any of those things. Nope, you know the drill. It's the beginning of the show, and as always, it's time for the global warming update. It's just a little thing I like to talk about. In my very first podcast, I focused on the importance of global warming and what we could do to help reduce our emissions on a local level. So I found that I found this story. Recently, the mayor and the city of Anchorage, Alaska, held a 2-day conference entitled "Strengthening Our Cities: Mayors Responding to Global Climate Change." It was a 2-day conference held September 16th through the 17th to focus on ways that cities could help to reduce their emissions of greenhouse gases. As always, I have a link to the story at the research links page for indirectdemocracy.com, and it includes the list of mayors that attended this conference. And looking over the list, I noticed that the mayor of my city did not attend. So, as I mentioned, in trying to do my part, and hopefully all of our parts, in helping to reduce emissions on a local level, I decided to write the mayor of my city a letter, and here is a copy of it. I'm going to read this to you. As you all know, I live in Orange County. So, to Miguel Pulido, the mayor of Santa Ana, California, where I live, dear Mr. Mayor, I'm a resident of the city of Santa Ana and a registered voter. As a voter, I hold my responsibility to vote with great pride and do my best to educate myself on many issues that affect my city, my state, and country. Recently, I've begun to educate myself on the issue of global warming and climate change. It's my belief, along with that of the scientific community, that this is a real threat to our planet. On September 16th through the 17th, 30 mayors from throughout the United States went to Anchorage, Alaska, to attend a meeting called "Strengthening Our Cities, Mayors Responding to Global Climate Change." At this meeting, the mayors, along with United States Senator Lisa Murkowski, met with business leaders, climate scientists, and local community leaders to discuss climate change and the ways that cities can reduce their output of greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide or CO2. I believe it is all our duty, to ourselves and our children's futures, to reduce our carbon footprints. However, since our federal government is slow to react to this issue, I am writing to you. Since your office did not attend, I am respectfully requesting you to attend this meeting next year and look into the possibility of attending similar meetings that may occur in this state or elsewhere in the United States. Even if you don't believe that our climate is changing, there are valid economic reasons to do this. According to the press release issued by the mayor's office in Anchorage, in 2004 alone, the 147 cities taking steps to reduce emissions saved $600 million in energy costs. Please do what can be done to reduce and help reverse a very real threat to our world, even if it is just to save our city lost money due to increased energy costs. It can be a start. Thank you for your attention to this matter. Sincerely, David Quintana, and host of Indirect Democracy. Now, realizing that maybe you would go to the research links and check to see if your mayor attended, I also decided to include a copy of this letter with blank spots for you to fill in. If you go to the favorite link section of the homepage for indirectdemocracy.com, you will find the link for letter to your mayor. If you want to, fill in the blanks and write your mayor. I really do encourage it, and for the price of a stamp, we can let our leaders know that this issue does matter. So, speaking of issues and news bits, earlier today, that's our bit for global warming for this week. I was looking at the president's approval ratings, and they are spiking at an average of 41%. Now, it's 45 if you like to see the big colors in USA Today, but part of this spike is partly related to the drop in the price of gasoline. I'm sure if you've gone to buy gasoline, you've noticed that the price has started to drop. Well, you know, like most people, I really started to notice the price of gas falling when it hit about $3 a gallon for regular unleaded. If you're listening outside of California, just a month ago, I was paying around $3.50 a gallon for Supreme, and don't get me started on Supreme versus regular. I just get it, and although my car is old, the engine doesn't knock, so that's helpful. But the natural feeling for all of us is to feel good about the price of gas when it begins to fall. You know, it makes you feel like you're getting a bargain. But I was thinking about this, and what kills me about all of this is that the price of gas has not changed. I mean, not really. It's just been so high for so long that we forgot that the oil companies didn't kiss us after they screwed us. So I decided to look up a little bit of information. Here's a little tidbit. The average price of gasoline, according to the Energy Information Administration, as of this week, and it'll vary, of course, is about $2.61 for the nationwide average. It's a decrease of about 34 cents from last month when it was $2.95. So, once again, got me more curious, and I decided to check the price of crude. And last month, the price of a barrel of crude averaged around $73, and as of now, it's about $63. So, once again, that put into another question in my mind. What was the price for a barrel of crude last year, and what was the price of gas? Now, according to WTRG Economics, and all this information will be up at the research links, the price of crude in 2005 averaged between $53 and $60. The average price of gas in September of 2005 was $2.90. Let me repeat that so you understand that. In 2005, the price of crude was less than what it is now, but the price of gas was higher. I still find myself stunned by that. Now, in 2006, the price of crude is higher than it was last year, but the average price of gas is lower. In fact, a full 34 cents lower. So, I'm not a fan of conspiracy theories, but this got me to ask an important question. What makes this year different? What could be occurring in the future that would cause an indirect effect on the president's popularity and want people to vote for the party in charge? So in my mind, I asked the question, is the price of gasoline being controlled to help the Republicans stay in power in October? Well, I did a Google search, asked that question, and I found an answer by Gil Kranberg, who writes for the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University. In his article, "The Closer the Election, the Lower the Price of Gas," he writes, and I quote, "I looked for guidance from three people knowledgeable about oil markets and put this more neutral question to each. Is there possibly a link between the drop in gas prices in this country and the coming election? One said flatly no, it's just due to lower demand now than during the driving season. Another said he was puzzled by the drop because people he trusts tell him it is not due to or cannot be explained by a comparable drop in crude oil prices. The third had a similar reaction, noting that in the past, when the price of crude oil dropped, the price of gasoline took much longer to come down. He said the price of gas customarily declines with the end of the driving season, but not as sharply as it has in the last few weeks, and certainly never went down faster than the price of crude as it has. The latter two respondents independently referred me to Peter K. Ashton, a longtime consultant on petroleum issues who has testified on gasoline pricing before the U.S. Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. Ashton's response to the same question, "As an economist, I cannot speculate on the politics that may be involved, but my recent research suggests that the recent drop cannot be explained by the drop in crude prices or the change in inventories alone. From an economic standpoint, therefore, it certainly raises questions in my mind as to whether the high prices we saw this summer were in any way justified by market fundamentals. I do not believe that they were. To the extent that prices are now declining more than the market fundamentals might dictate suggests to me that a decision has been made to reduce prices back to levels that might be considered more in line with the forces of supply and demand. Whether that is a politically motivated decision is up to others to decide, not me. Nevertheless, it is clear to me that the prices we witnessed this summer could not be justified by the market. End quote. So I checked up another article. In another article written by the Energy Information and Information Administration, or EIA, this article entitled Oil Prices Continue to Drop states, quote, in the last 5 weeks since August 7th, oil prices for both crude and petroleum products have dropped substantially. The price of West Texas Intermediate crude oil has fallen $77 per barrel to below $64 per barrel. Retail gasoline prices have dropped 42 cents per gallon to $2.62 as of September 11th. Will the declines continue, or will they begin to level off and possibly increase later this year? According to the EIA's most recent short-term energy outlook released yesterday, EIA expects the price of WTI crude oil during the fourth quarter of 2006 to average around $70 per barrel, gasoline prices to average below $2.60, and the EIA is expecting the recent price decline to slow, with prices then leveling off and possibly increasing later this year. For crude oil markets, the global situation is about as rosy as has been the case in the last several months. Concerns about a possible oil disruption from Iran have faded, as the diplomatic push to get Iran to halt enrichment of nuclear material has not yet led to sanctions imposed by the UN Security Council, and Iran has recently stated its willingness to continue negotiations with the UN. Now, this is just my own quote, but I'm guessing we can only hope that's going to last after the president's speech recently, and he stated that he held no quarrel against the Iranian people, but called out their government. And to be honest, I wonder when was the last time I heard a speech like that. Okay, back to the quotation. Mid-September has arrived without a single hurricane affecting oil facilities in the Gulf of Mexico, and with no storms likely to arrive within at least the next week. Nigeria, where significant disruptions have occurred with some frequency over the past 2 years, has been quiet. Let's see, even the one disruption, which was the BP pipeline leak in Alaska, now appears to be much less of a problem than originally thought, end quote. And one more article I looked up, which is called U.S. Controls Price of Crude Oil, comes from the People's Daily Online. And you can take that from whatever political standpoint you want, but I found the quotation interesting. Quote, one of the latest reasons for the drop in oil price is the increase in inventory. According to the EIA, the U.S. oil inventory increased unexpectedly during peak oil consumption seasons, but the oil output of OPEC did not augment. The oil output in Russia, a crude oil supplier, climbed constantly in the wake of continual oil price hikes. Russia has exceeded Saudi Arabia to become the largest producer in the world. In the first 8 months of the year, the crude oil yield in Russia was down 318.15 million tons, 2.5% more than the previous year. However, all Russia can do is fine-tune the price. In fact, only the U.S. can control the price of oil. This May, when the Bush administration gave the order to suspend its strategic oil inventory, the price of oil fell under the control of the government. According to the author's statistics and analysis, the U.S. strategic oil inventory keeps positive correlation with the price of WTI stable with a correlation coefficient of 0.87. In the author's opinion, the purpose of suspending the oil inventory is to control oil prices. Furthermore, in July, when the price of crude oil reached a new high, the U.S. government claimed it would use its strategic oil inventory to restrain the price if necessary. After that, oil prices began to fall. Why does the U.S. want to curb the price of crude oil this year? End quote. Why indeed? The facts from all these articles point to a greater supply to a lesser demand, which would rationally explain the price of gas falling. But the experts agree not to the levels that match the price of crude. So we have to ask this question. Why is it that the price of gas is around $2.06 a gallon in Iowa, where the governor's office and two House seats are up for grabs? Maybe we've all forgotten what the price of gas used to be, so I looked it up. We're so used to being at near $3 that we forget that only 3 years ago, it was about $1.62 on average for the nation. 2 years ago, $1.87. That was just a 25-cent increase. Last year, it jumped to $2.48 and then to $2.95 last month. 25 cents from 1 year jumped to over $1 in 2 years. So, yes, the price of gas is falling, but according to the EIA, the falling price is temporary, and they expect little relief from the current pricing patterns. The real question to ask is the price being manipulated in an effort to manipulate your vote? Well, I guess we'll have to keep it in mind when we talk to our friends, families, and coworkers who vote, and keep an eye on those prices at the pump, and make up your own mind about it. So, speaking of gas, this is a news tidbit. Did you know that according to U.S. News, according to U.S. World News and Reports, that the president is a big fan of the fart jokes? It's a gas-related story. It's okay. It's true. The Prez likes the old come here and pull my finger. And also, this is from U.S. News and World Reports. He's also a big fan of the Sharpie pen and has his own sets of them with his name and President of the United States engraved onto them. So, I gotta admit, there's so much of what he does that makes me giggle. He has jackets, boots, and all forms of paraphernalia with the presidential logo and his name on them. But the Sharpie pens got me thinking. This is really like the guy who wants to be ready to autograph something to remind you and himself of his own fame. I mean, doesn't it remind you of that? I mean, it almost seems that he wants to clarify, his image as a leader and not that he is the leader. It's once again that feeling that he's pushing the image. It's like he wants to be the mythical sports hero he never got to be, and I blame this on Bud Selig for not letting him become baseball commissioner. I'm having a tough time talking again tonight, and I thank you for listening anyway. pens, jackets, golf balls, boots, all with his name on them, and to me it's a lot like having your name written on your underwear when you're a kid. Which, oddly enough, requires a Sharpie pen. Sharpies and farts. I wonder which smell he likes better. Okay, well, since we are talking about the president, and as it is our opinion that it is time to give him some good advice and something better than what he's done before, it is time for the presidential horoscope. And here from the pages of Elle magazine is his career horoscope. And as we know, our president is a Cancer. So here is his Cancer horoscope for this week. His meter reading again is a 7 for September 18th through the 24th. Precision and planning should already be in place this week. If you're not yet at this stage, get busy. Friday and Saturday may surprise you by suddenly bringing things in a cohesive, we're really getting somewhere kind of way. Just keep plugging along and anticipate that you may work through the weekend. Oh, he's not going to like that. Particularly if you're launching a new business venture. It's recommended that you buy stock or other ownership privileges in a nascent venture if you're an employee or a consultant. And this week's touchstones are smoky quartz and jade. So last week we talked briefly about the path to 9/11 because admittedly I haven't really seen it and I still haven't seen it. I thought about downloading it from iTunes because I think it's free. So if anybody watched it, of course, hold up your hands. Doesn't matter, I can't see you. It's like 6 past the hour. It could have been 6 past the hour for me. Maybe it's not for you. Maybe, once again, psychic, and you're just wondering why it is that I know what time it is. But as I mentioned, last week I watched a little bit over an hour of it. I think it was mostly about an hour and 20 minutes. But I did talk with a close family member who did see it, and we talked about really what had many of the people who were concerned about it, why they were right to be concerned. This person automatically cited the moments in the movie where members of the Clinton administration did nothing to kill or capture Osama bin Laden, and that torture was probably the right way to deal with terrorists that we've captured. Now, this got me thinking about our current discussion out there politically and in the news about Article 3 of the Geneva Convention and the President's latest push to reform the laws to deal with military tribunals and how we treat our prisoners at Gitmo. Now, as many of you know, last week, the President held a press conference in the Rose Garden to discuss the need for clarification of Article 3 of the Geneva Convention, which deals with outrages against human dignity. It was a term that the President called vague. Now, General Powell, General Jack Vesey, and John McCain, who was a prisoner of war and was subjected to torture, have all spoke out against this kind of reinterpretation of a portion of an international treaty that has stood for over 50-plus years and recognized that if we were to reverse our stand on how to treat those we hold in detention, well, we'll lose whatever moral and legal standing that this country has left in the world. It will most likely subject our soldiers and even citizens to the kind of kangaroo courts we so often denounce, as in this piece by Glenn Greenwald discussing an article by Michelle Malkin, a conservative commentator and regular on the Fox network. And this is Mr. Greenwald's piece, and I quote, "Michelle Malkin is extremely upset because three convicted Christian terrorists in Indonesia are going to be executed despite, in Michelle's words, grave doubts raised over the fairness of the trial. The title of her post is, Muslims Will Execute Christians, by which she means that the government of a predominantly Muslim country will execute three defendants who happen to be Christian because they also happen to have been convicted in a trial in an Indonesian court of law of masterminding a massacre of 200 Muslims in Poso." Now, I haven't become that familiar with this particular article by Ms. Malkin, but the overall effect of what Mr. Greenwald has to say in accordance with Ms. Malkin's is important. And I continue the quote. "According to the article to which Malkin linked, the complaint is that the terrorists were convicted by a trial riddled with illegalities, like witnesses who were not listened to and evidence that was rejected by the court." This is his quote, not mine. Wow, a trial where witnesses are not listened to and improper evidence was used? What kind of country would convict someone of terrorism using procedures like that? And what kind of disgusting barbarians would be opposed to having the International Criminal Court of Geneva, pursuant to an international human rights convention, demand greater legal protection for terrorists? This post writes itself. This is still Mr. Greenwald. "For instance, I thought, from having read Michelle's blog, that people who were concerned about due process for terrorists are themselves pro-terrorists. I wonder what it is about this case that makes Michelle and Gateway Pundit so concerned for the rights of terrorists, when normally they mock those who express such concern. Maybe the U.S. government could intervene on behalf of the convicted terrorists and insist that even accused terrorists have the right to a fair trial and due process, and that it is inhumane and barbaric to impose the death penalty after convicting them of terrorism without first giving them a trial free of any irregularities. A fair trial prior to execution is, after all, a universal value, even for terrorists." End quote. Now, trust me when I say that no one, especially a liberal, and I count myself among them, condones terrorist actions. I have argued for the continued war in Afghanistan to capture and bring to justice Osama bin Laden. But the type of change to the Geneva Convention requested by the President changes our stance on 150 years of international law and a portion of that law that has been part of our law for 50-plus years, which is therefore the supreme law of the land. This is not the only group or nation that has fought to extinguish any one country, even our own. Yet the beauty and wonder of the United States is that we're a country founded on an idea. Freedom. We weren't based on a nationality or ethnicity, but on a precept that we're all free. That to ensure that freedom, we adhere to a set of laws to define us, and that in the end, there is equal justice under those laws. Now, that's the theory, and too often we know it doesn't work. But we aspire to that idea because it's part of what we define as our greatness. And when any one person or institution looks at you and says, those laws shouldn't matter because this threat's too great, then what they're really saying is that person, that movie, that country, that belief, including terrorism, is greater than the idea that binds us together as a people. Yes, sadly, one day we may be hit again. But what will be the greater victory? Their one day, or the continuation of our way of life? Myself, I pray it's what we aspire to. Because if it's not, then terrorism has destroyed the United States of America. Oh, whew. Well, I need a break. And so do you. So, here's this word from our newest sponsor. It's tough finding the right words. That's why, here at Hallmark, we say it for you.
It's my boss's birthday.
Yep, we have that card.
It's my son's first Halloween.
Yep, we have that card. In fact, at Hallmark, our dedicated and trained professionals work hard to express your feelings when no other words will say it.
My neighbor just got out of surgery, and I shot her.
Yep, we have that card.
I fell off the wagon, and I need to tell my sponsor.
Yep, we have that card. From birthdays to Christmas, Mother's Day to graduation, keep it in touch to I love you. Hallmark will say it all.
I need to apologize to Muslims all over the world.
Yep, we have that card. Hallmark will say it for you. Well, it's time to give out our What a Weenie Award. This week's Declaration of Weeniedom will go to the Ford Motor Company. This week, Ford announced it was slashing a third of its company's salaried employees, reducing the level of employees it has from 130,000 to 92,000 by 2008. It also offered buyouts of its 75,000 hourly workers and announced it would close two additional plants, creating a total of 16 closed plants by 2008. In his statement, Mark Fields, the executive vice president of Ford Motor Company, announced, "The simple fact is that the business model that served us in North America for decades no longer works." Really? No, I mean, really, is it that obvious? You know, I still remember very well the gas shortage of the 70s. You know, I waited with my family in lines to get gasoline on the days that matched our license plate while listening to complaints and gripes of drivers who were still in large gas-guzzling cars. All the while, foreign car makers were introducing smaller and more fuel-efficient cars to counter what was being sold. You know, they sold these cars due to the demand for reliable, fuel-efficient cars. And in the meantime, the American car manufacturer was suffering because, you know, it was lost in its belief that it had to focus on larger and less fuel-efficient cars. So, I remember as a kid, we used to talk about the day when gas would run out due to the way cars were made. In the 80s, that timeline was somewhat drawn back when fuel injection helped increase our miles per gallon. In fact, when I bought my car, it got about 25 miles per gallon in the city and 30 miles per gallon on the highway, which now is what the standard is. So, I waited for the time when technology would increase our miles per gallon and once again increase the amount of oil supply. So, when hybrid technology arrived, you know, I thought that day had come. But not so much for Ford or the American car companies. Ford continued with its North American plan to sell more trucks and SUVs, and all the while, people were buying up these gas guzzlers, and the supply of oil dropped, and the price of gas rose to rates never imagined. It's one thing for Ford to not have paid attention to its history. If they had worked as hard as Toyota and Honda to sell hybrids in the United States, maybe Ford and GM would not be laying off this many hard-working Americans. But they didn't. Worse still, if you go to Ford's own website and hit their link for global sites, you'll see that the first cars that are focused on are cars like the Ford Galaxy, which is sold in England and gets an average of 35 miles per gallon. In Brazil, the Ford EcoSport, which is a crossover, can run on ethanol. You know, of course they still sell trucks and SUVs in other countries, but those websites don't focus on muscle first. they focus on efficiency. So, because Ford failed to remember its own history at the expense of tens of thousands of jobs, they are the official recipients of this week's What a Weenie Award. Well, once again, want to thank you for listening. Of course, I would be remiss if I didn't thank Matt Bloodwell and the guys at Megaphone for allowing me to use their song, Not Your Enemy, from the album For Crying Out Loud. It's available at www.megaphonemusic.net and myspace.com/megaphone. You can also get it through iTunes. Got it recently, and it is a fun album. And also, if you are a fan of Marc Maron, his new website is back, still under construction, but markmaron.com, he got control of it again. So, once again, thank you for listening. Look forward to seeing you next week. Take care of yourselves and take care of each other. I'm hoping it's the Sharpie smell.